blending his expertise in history and his passion for radio, this is Our Roots and Ready with your host, Greg Cobelt.
And you're listening to Our Roots in Reading, a WEEU podcast. I am your host, Greg Cobelt. I am so excited to get into this episode 2, our next topic of the Our Roots in Reading series. It's history of Berks County and Reading. And this is a great timely topic for this time of year, as the major league season and the minor league season, the Reading Phillies, have started in April. And we're going to be talking about baseball today, the history of baseball in Berks County. It's like all history in Berks County, like we've already talked about. It's very rich. There's so much to unpack. And luckily, I have a great guest. But before I introduce him, you know, I grew up in neighboring Chester County. I was a baseball player my whole life. And I definitely have played in Reading baseball for travel ball. There's some fields up here and some teams I got to play with in the Reading area growing up. This topic is close to my heart as it came from my childhood. And we're going to talk about a lot of the major league teams that have played in Reading, in addition to the history of Reading Phillies and First Energy Stadium as we know today. And there's an extensive long history. So I'm very happy that I got a great guest for this topic. His name's Brian Engelhardt. He's a writer for the Historical Review for 20 years. He writes about local baseball history. He's also a part of the Society for American Baseball Research. He is an ambassador for the Berks Historical Society and on the Board of Trustees. And he is the author of a book that we'll be referencing throughout the podcast. It's called Reading's Big League Exhibition Games. It's by Brian Engelhardt. And he's also a professor at Albright College and has written a number of articles in the Historical Review of Berks about baseball. And he makes a lot of speeches and guest appearances, most recently in Cooperstown. So I'm going to introduce him right now. He's in the studio with us, Brian. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Good morning.
How was Cooperstown? You were there just last week, right?
I was there just till yesterday.
Yeah.
It was the annual 19th century baseball get-together by the 19th century section of the American Society for American Baseball Research. The Fred Ivor Conference, Frederick Ivor Conference, known as the Fred to those that go there. And I was lucky enough to be, this is the third year in a row, I'm with one of 15 presenters with the topic that I spoke about. And my topic was Harry Shadow Pyle, a Reading native who was a pitcher in the 1880s, pitched for a lot of minor league teams, five games in the major leagues, and was a person that made a lot of poor choices in his personal life.
Yeah.
And then they changed the rule.
Like a lot of baseball players, it seems like, back
yes.
then, right?
Yeah,
and some of the better ones, I guess.
And as Trevor Bauer would tell you nowadays, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyhow, but they changed the rules on him. They not to get too esoteric, in 1887... they changed the rule. They had pitcher's boxes. They didn't have a mound. They had a box. And the mound...
Just a flat kind of patch of dirt.
Yeah, and a square. About 6... It varied between 4.5 to 5 across, depending on the year, and 6 to 5.5. Until 1887, you could start anywhere in the box and run up to the line like a cricket pitcher and throw the ball.
Yeah.
As long as you didn't go across the last line. In 1887, they said, no. You have to have your back foot on the back line, and you can take one step, which is what we do now. And that was fine for everybody except people that depended on running starts. And that ended Shadow Pyle's career, because he went from being a good pitcher to being a... putts.
And that still happens today in sports, where, you know, in basketball or baseball, there's, you know, some rule where a player is always able to get a foul or able to manipulate something, and then they change it up, and all of a sudden their game's out the window.
And he ended up umping games back in Reading. And there you go. But he had an odyssey of a career pitching for a lot of minor league teams, and people seemed to enjoy it. So there, but that's not why you had me here, the 19th century. But anyway, but...
Well, your book, Reading's Big League Exhibition Games, Exhibition Games is in the title, and I was born in 1999. I wasn't too familiar with exhibition games and the whole concept. You know, I've never been to one in my life. Hmm. Well, first of all, what is an exhibition game? And when did they start here in Reading? And what were some of the big names or more notable exhibition games that were played here?
Spring training games are exhibition games. It's in essence, they're games that don't count in the official standings. They had, which they don't do anymore, several kinds of exhibition games back in the day. One is the preseason exhibition games, other than spring training games, but they'd play a couple of games. And actually, the Phillies did that. They had the Orioles, when they opened up the new ballpark, they had the Orioles, and one time they had the Pirates here. Play a game or two in the big park in the new park that just so the fans could see what the park was like. Preseason games, they've had them here, but then they stopped. In season games, when the team would have a day off, the owner would say, "Ah, we have a day off. Let's make some money somewhere else." And Connie Mack would contact the owner of the minor league team would be in Reading. I'm using him as an example. He'd say, "Hey, how about I bring some of my boys up and we have an exhibition game?"
From the big leagues.
Yeah, bring some of my Philadelphia A's up or whoever the Phillies – how about I bring the Phillies up? This was before the Reading Phillies. This is back in the day. And Connie would bring a group up or the Phillies or whatever, and they would play a game, and people would say, "Oh, boy, we got to see Major Leaguer." And they would pay good bucks, and Connie would get a share of the gate, or the Phillies would, whoever the big league team would get a share of the gate. And it would generate fan interest. It would make money for the big league team. The players hated it because they got nothing. And they had postseason exhibition games, which were known as barnstorming, where a team would go through, make a tour in October after the season was over, and play games, and again, fan interest. Yeah, the weather was good, and you got to see big league players, and it made some money. 1904, John McGraw's New York Giants won the National League pennant. John McGraw hated the brand new American League, and he wouldn't defile his team by playing something called a World Series with the American League team, the Boston Red Sox, that year, that won the pennant. And he said, "Boys, would you like to go make some money on a barnstorming tour? That would be better than a World Series." And they went, "Oh, sure." And one of the stops they made was Reading. So people got to see the New York Giants in 1904 and Christy Mathewson, and they won the pennant. And that was a postseason exhibition game with a barnstorming tour.
So a lot of these exhibition games that we're talking about are a major league team playing a minor league team in their hometown. A lot of times that happened, or it was major league teams going to a different location like Reading and playing in one of the fields that Reading had before First Energy Stadium was built or something like that. So in your book, it starts out with a lot of pictures of old-time baseball players from the late 1800s and the early 1900s. A lot of teams that don't exist anymore, but they were considered major league teams. And you know, if they wanted to come to Reading and generate some excitement around them or revenue, what were some of the locations that these exhibition games were played at, and what happened to them?
Well, the first there's four places that come to mind. Probably there's more. Actually, one comes to mind was on the other side of the Schuylkill. Ball games were played on what was called the yellow clay area on the other side of the Schuylkill. In the 19th century, exhibition games, I don't think so, but that was a popular site that ball games were played. The nicest new place was what is now the 11th and Pike Playground. That was known as the Ball Grounds. And in the 1893, a guy named Whitman, William Whitman, built a nice grandstand there. They played games there, but it was rather rudimentary. But that was the first popular area. It was known as the Reading Ball Grounds at the 11th and Pike, or the 10th and whatever. In the paper, it had different addresses, but you get the idea. That's where that was one place. Another place, William Whitman built himself something called the Coliseum. He had grandiose aspirations, and it's now Albright's Stadium. Sadly, Bill, I called him Lucky Bill Whitman. He built the pagoda, too, and he lost that, never got to use it. He lost it in a foreclosure. It's now the icon of the city of Reading. Yeah. But
he seems like he derives ideas from faraway lands like, you know, Rome and China.
As I said, grandiose. Yeah. Anyway, that was the Coliseum. So there's some exhibition games played there. He had a ball team that played there off and on during the 1911 to 1915 season, off and on. Different game teams would go broke. But that was that. Another one was the most popular one in the B4. Lowers Park was at like 4th and Buttonwood Street, which is now a youth stadium that's, I think, called Gordon Hudak. It's a beautiful park, was built about 15, 20 years ago, and dedicated. Mudcat Grant came here and several other pitchers from Major League Baseball for the dedication. Anyway, that was built in 1907. It was made of wood. And a series of minor league teams played there over the years. The longest stretch was in 1919, a team that was called for a year, the Reading Coal Heavers, or Coal Barons, played there. They stunk. So they had another name the next year. They were the Reading Marines. The Marines stunk too. A bad team by any other name is still a bad team, as Shakespeare said. And so they became the Reading Aces. Well, they stunk too. And finally they came the Reading Keys. And then they had a little more success, but off and on they stunk. But they lasted from 1919 to 1932, when in the middle of the season the Reading Keys became the Albany Senators and left town.
Moved all the way up to the capital, New York.
Yes, they moved to Albany. The stadium was made of wood. A couple of other minor league teams played there. They had a low they were in the International League, the Reading Keys. I'll just say lots of exhibition games were played in Lowers Park over the years because they did anything to get fannies in the seats. The next team, 33 and 34, you had the Reading Red Sox. That was low minor leagues, not the International League. And then 1940 and 41, they had the Reading Chicks and then the Reading Brooks. Rather than buy Carl Fiorillo's contract, the Brooklyn Dodgers found that it was cheaper to buy the Reading Chicks because of the terrible state of the franchise at that time. So Carl Fiorillo, the Reading Rifle, was a member of the 41 Reading Brooks, and they were a good team. And they were the last team to have a regular schedule. World War II came along. A lot of the minor league teams discontinued play, including the Brooks. And then in 1943, Lowers Park was demolished. So there was no ballpark except for George Field, which had a 3,000-person capacity. They had three exhibition games there in the 40s. 44, they had the Dodgers and the A's came, and the house was packed because they only could let 3,500. And then the Cardinals, who won the World Championship in 46, came with local hero Whitey Karowski, who was a hero of the World Series in 41 and was a star third baseman for the Cardinals.
So a good way to think of this is all these teams you're mentioning that were, you know, operating in the early 1900s. They're kind of like a bunch of little businesses.
Oh, yeah.
They're well right. Said. That's really, I mean, that's essentially what a team is. A professional sports team is a business, and the product is watching baseball. And as we can see, it's not that easy to put together a team, pay for everything, the jerseys, the travel, and all the expenses that come with that. And if people aren't interested in the Reading Keys or the, you know, Barons or whoever it is, people from the outside are going to start looking at wanting to buy them. Would you say the structure of baseball at this point in history in the early 1900s is a bunch of independent teams just trying to turn a profit? They're not connected to a major league team. Are these just businessmen setting up all these different teams in Reading trying to drum up revenue?
There were a few in Reading, but yes, they would fail, and then they'd pick themselves up, start all over again. Bill Whitman being one of them. He also ran for mayor of Reading four times, lost.
four-peat.
You haven't lived here very long, but the Spring Street Subway, you'll see it flood eventually, but he designed the Spring Street Subway that goes underneath the railroad pass there and floods every rainstorm, major rainstorm, but that Bill designed that too. So he left his mark on the... Anyhow.
Infamous, yeah.
One season in 1892, they had five people at the last game that Actives game played. The next season, they moved a team down from Danville halfway through the season, and we had baseball here again. Nobody was coming to the game in Danville. Bill Whitman bought the team. They moved down from Danville. So, yes, they had, and still, baseball does have minor league entrepreneurs even in this time. MLB, the monolith for Major League Baseball, has taken over much of the operations of the minor league network. Notice, Reading Phillies used to run their own website, and now MLB runs all the minor league websites. MLB just had a requirement, and God bless, we have $20 million, essentially, about, that have been infused into our stadium here in Reading to bring it up to snuff to the MLB requirements. And we were fortunate enough to have contributions from various levels of government and also from the Phillies that come up, and I'm looking forward to getting out there. I haven't been able to get out there to see these improvements, but that's what MLB's done with the current product.
So earlier in history, a lot of these minor league teams were independent clubs trying to make a name for themselves. But over the decades spanning up until today, these organizations clung on to a major league franchise who owns them and runs them.
Big change. The old days, the team owned the players, and the team made its profit, A, from the fannies in the seats, and B, from selling the players, including the Reading franchise. At a certain point, the major leagues took over the furnishing of the players to minor league teams at all levels. So now, and this has been for my life, the big league team gives you the players and essentially tells you who to play in general. If they have a great prospect, they give leeway, but sometimes the leeway is less... less big.
Yeah,
this guy's got to play.
It's more of a front office decision.
Absolutely.
At that point.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, in any event, that is a major change. So, seeing the Reading Phillies, what you're the strings are being pulled as to the who's on the team by the Philadelphia organization, and who's there, who goes up, who goes down. That ain't the decision of the management of the Reading Phillies or. Although their manager has some input, but it's the front office.
So exhibition games it's a way that teams would make money by traveling to different cities and trying to attract people from that town, like Reading, to you know, come see a baseball game, whether it was a pro club playing another pro club, or eventually it was a lot of times the Philadelphia Phillies would play the Reading Phillies at First Energy Stadium. There was a number of those that happened up until the year 2000, right?
That was an inducement oftentimes by the major league team to for the minor league team, where the minor league team would get a larger share of the gate. That was, we'll come to play you, and you get all the gate if it's being really generous.
Right. Like we'll bring our star power and create some extra, you know, money for you guys.
And you'll see the star power for the first and second inning, but you won't see the star power pitch. Usually, in exhibition games, it was I did say Christy Mathewson pitched. That wouldn't happen nowadays. Steve Carlton never pitched in Reading. There's a story about to complete the point. They came so people could be get a flavor of the big league, see them up close and personal. There they were, right in front of you, and Joe Bouzas, who ran the Reading Red Sox, and then ultimately the Reading Phillies for a number of years, the Red Sox played the Cubs. The Boston Red Sox played the Chicago Cubs here in 1964, and the Boston Red Sox said, "After our expenses are paid, Joe, this is part of this. This is an inducement to you as the owner. So this is kind of a kicker." From us to you.
And the reason why we don't really see major league teams going to smaller towns and playing the minor league teams today is a number of reasons. Obviously, the level of play in the MLB is so taxing and competitive. You know, a lot of these players don't want to, on their off day or on, you know, a time when there's a break in the season to travel and play another game and risk injury and all that. But the closest exhibition games we have today are like spring training, because right. The Phillies will play the Detroit Tigers in Clearwater, Florida.
Right.
And that's pretty much what an exhibition game is. It's you can watch a preseason game, two MLB teams in Florida.
Absolutely. And there's they used to take trains, and the trains would stop at different places along the way. So they play in Memphis, Tennessee. The Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs were taking the train up north, and they stopped here. And they just happened to play here. Bottom line, the players' agreement now requires a day off every 20 days. And a day off is a day off. And you said the schedule is so tight.
Yeah, you look at the schedule this week. I mean, the Phillies are in Cincinnati every day, and then they're flying out to San Diego. Probably not going to be able to come to a smaller stadium and kind of play like a for fun kind of game. That doesn't really count for the standings.
And I don't know if it's in the player contract or not, but I wouldn't be surprised. And by the way, there will be no exhibition games before or after the season, unless it is totally, it's waived by the union. And the union ain't going to waive that.
No.
So, but they would have postseason games and the like, and so.
The other thing I really like about your book is it's a lot of pictures, historical pictures,
yes,
with the descriptions next to them, and it's really great to look through the first part of it, because, you know, you get a lot of the old 1900s players with the handlebar mustache, and their name is, you know, Curly or something, you know.
George Piano Legs Gore is one of my favorite nicknames. George, he played for the Chicago White Stockings. They came to town and, of course, beat the snot out of our local team, but the people didn't care. The Boston Red Stockings of 1875 came here. Yeah, exhibition games go back to the early
1870s
'70s. They began
in Reading. Played in Reading in the 1870s. Yeah,
yeah, and the Boston Red Stockings, I think their record was 75-9 in the National Association that year, and they come to Reading, and they see the Actives is who they're going to play, the semi-pro team. And they see Frank Heifer, who was the best player on the Actives, is warming up. And George Wright, the manager of the team, says, I like the way this guy's warming up. So they not only beat the actives 20-9 or 20-8, something like that. They signed Frank Kiefer and took their best player with them when they left town. So then Frank played a couple of games that year for the Boston Red Stockings, but that was an interesting beginning with a very great team that was in a different era.
So a lot of exhibition games played in Reading's history. Now we get to the point where we have First Energy Stadium, which is where the Reading Phillies play today.
Right.
That's built in 1951. The Reading Phillies, that franchise as we know today, was not established until 1967. But before the stadium was even built, the Reading Indians played here. Could you explain how that all worked? Why the Reading Indians, an affiliate of the Cleveland Indians, were in Reading for so long?
The stadium was built in 51, and if you build it, they will come. And they didn't have a team. It just was being built, and there you go. In 1952, the Cleveland Indians were disenchanted with how things were going with their franchise in Wilkes-Barre. And they thought, oh, maybe it'll go better. And so they entered into a franchise agreement with the management of the baseball team here, or the baseball organization here. The team came here because Cleveland said, well, it'll go better. Under the franchise agreement, the big club gets money. One way or another, they get a front fee, they might get part of the gate, they get any number of other things. It's a matter of what gets negotiated. Bottom line is, they started playing here in 52, and as an inducement, the Cleveland Indians came to Reading in 52, 53, 54, and 55. In 55, when they came here, it was that great team that went to the World Series and lost to the New York Giants in 54. But they had great players. What you didn't see were any of their star pitchers, Early Wynn, Bob Lemon. You seldom saw really good pitchers because they wanted them to rest. Even at least they had their pitching rest. But each year, and this was the problem, the Reading Indians were here. Each year the attendance would go down, and the attendance to see the Cleveland Indians began to shrink. It first year it was like 6,000, and then it was down to like 3,500 in 55. The Cleveland said, no, we're not coming anymore. TV was a horrible thing for the minor leagues during the 60s. During the 50s, I'm sorry. People said, well, why do we need to see minor leaguers? We can see the big leaguers on TV. And Reading was just part of the problem that all minor leagues suffered from. So we had these four exhibition games from the Cleveland Indians, and one, the last one, as I said, was like less than 4,000 people in the stadium. Cleveland eventually left town after the 61 season. They didn't draw well. And they went to Charleston, West Virginia with their franchise team. 62, we had nobody here. 63, the Boston Red Sox moved 2 years, 63-64, with a fellow, as I said, Joe Bouzas, who was known as the Marco Polo of minor league baseball. His team had moved around, and he had several other teams elsewhere as well. But they played in Reading for 2 years. One of the games that was here was the game with the Cubs in 64. But even though they didn't do bad versus the major leagues, I mean, the other teams in the Eastern League, which is what they played in, Joe got a better offer for the use of a stadium up in Pittsfield and said, I got to leave.
So the reason the Cleveland Indians had their affiliate here in the first place was because there was a stadium and it made sense economically.
Yes, exactly. It was a nice new stadium. And maybe they'll draw more people in Reading than they
right.
will. And already we were known as a good baseball town, and now that's a trademark phrase. We are baseball town.
And that's why I think the Reading Phillies relationship with the Philadelphia Phillies is so interesting, because when I was growing up, I just thought, oh, yeah, the Reading Phillies, they're, 50 miles away from Philly. That makes sense. They're the minor league team. But that's really not the case for a lot of minor league teams. There are franchises in the major leagues who have their minor league teams many states away, right? I mean, they could be, 13-hour drive away or something like that. And that never really made sense to me, but it really is a common thing that it still exists today.
Yes. The San Francisco Giants, AA affiliate is in Richmond. Okay. It's pretty far away. The Phillies have developed, and it's to the credit of their front office, the team up in North Jersey, short of Edison, New Jersey, the Lakewood, that's their high A team now. You always want to have a team in a hot weather spot. So Clearwater, it might not be convenient, but it's hot. You can send people down there. Anyway, but having a team in Allentown and a team in Reading, they're very close. They can see who's developing. They can move them around. And that is a good network, and it's convenient for the Phillies. The Phillies have had their AAA team in Little Rock, in Eugene, Oregon, in Ottawa. Those weren't convenient.
It's so interesting, and it's also a testament to how lucky Reading is to have this franchise so connected to the Phillies. It is tied for the longest running affiliation with an MLB team. The Detroit Tigers.
Detroit Tigers has an equally long relationship with Lakewood on a lower A schedule. Both started in 67.
They started in 67 and to now. And I think the reasons the Cleveland Indians left and they went to Charleston, West Virginia.
And they came back here then. Charleston, while the Red Sox were playing here, Charleston was not being a welcoming home for the Indians. They moved them back here. And in 1965, they played here. And the Indians did not put a very good team out here. The best player most promising player they had was Ray Fosse, if you remember. He's the guy that Pete Rose ran into and ended his, what was turning out to be a very promising career. Yeah. He played after that, but not as effectively. But Ray Fosse was 18 years old, but he was one of the better players, and it was overmatched. The team was in last place. Whitey Karowski was the manager, but people don't come to see the manager. They come to see baseball. And local management group had paid a bond to Cleveland. They thought it was just a security bond, but Cleveland said, no, that was a franchise fee. They had the lowest attendance in the league. They drew 40,000 people in 70 home dates. And 8,500 of those people came on one night, Pony Night, when they gave away a pony, which was a phenomenon of the minor leagues for any number of years.
You wrote an article about Pony Night.
Yes,
sent that over to me. It's I just go in the picture of the kid sitting on the pony. It caused a lot of it was polarizing in a way.
Well, polarizing between the kid and her parents.
Yeah.
I want the pony. No, don't get to. Anyway.
That's usually a good business model when you make the kid into a craze, and then it kind of puts the parent into a chokehold in a way.
They would sell tickets to merchants for 3 tickets for $1, and then the merchants would give the tickets out to their customers. And as I said, 40,000 people would be the whole year's gate. And 8,500 in one night. Oh, and another night was Dairy Night. I don't know what I don't give a cow away. But 2,500 people came Dairy Night. So you take 11,000 people out of the 40. Now you have only 29,000 people. Now divide 29,000 without your calculator by 70. See what that averages out to. That sucks. That's terrible. and so you take, so the 11,000 people in 2 games, and they have about 600 people a night, if that. And Joe Boozes they used to have contests during games. Guess the crowd. And on some nights, you didn't have to guess the crowd, you could count. And he would tell his underling, "We're not having to guess the crowd tonight. You can count how many are in the stands." So he didn't want to give the free pie away or whatever.
It's not really a guess at that point. It's and then so. They're not even watching the game, and they're just counting all the heads, yeah.
But that goes into the charm of the business of baseball as it developed along the way. And Joe would be out making hot dogs and selling tickets when he was running the team. And to be a notable contrast with Craig Stein, who has, under Craig, we have had the good fortune, now the Phillies bought out the shares, a majority share from Craig, I understand. But bottom line is, we got a roof over the grandstand. We got the beer park in left field. We got the swimming pool in right field. The seats are filled in the stadium. And as a result, the regular attendance for 20 years was over 400,000 and still is around 400,000. We have a Cadillac franchise in Reading where it was nondescript for so many years. But the management of Craig and bringing Chuck Domino in, and now Scott Hunsinger, who was an intern for those fellows, has continued the management with his team along those lines. It's a good time. People then saw that you didn't just go out to see baseball. You went out for a time with the kids, and that was our fortune there. But the exhibition games still were a good time because they were stars.
Yeah, and again, it's just a testament to how lucky we are to have the Reading Phillies in the way they are here, because you know that's not something that just in every town in America, having such like a substantial and such a built up double A team with all that history to it, and all the money going into the stadium that just recently, all the improvements that were made.
Yes, I'll be, as I said, eager to see, but it's built it up, and it's in our community, it's a success story. That's something that we all should take vicarious pride in. But the leadership, Scott Hunsinger and the Reading Phillies management, it's been a benefit to the whole Berks community. One of the management people along the way in the history of Reading baseball, let's go back a little bit, 1941, the business manager of the Reading Brooks was 24-year-old a fellow named Lee McPhail. You've heard of Lee McPhail, right?
Yeah.
He only passed on a few years ago. He was 96. His son, Andy, is the president of the Phillies. Not as active as he had been, but he's down there. And he had another son that was the general manager of the Reading Phillies for a short time, and very sadly was killed in a car accident here. Lee's beginning with the Reading Brooks. He was running a stockyard down in South Carolina, and his dad, Larry McPhail, said, "Lee, you have a wife, you have a kid. What would you rather do, run a ball team as my business manager? We just bought the Reading Brooks and Carl Fiorillo. Or would you rather run a stockyard?" Well, he was up here no time at all. And he needed to get fannies in the seats. They were getting an average of about 600 people a game. So through different connections, he had the Pirates, the Phillies, the Cubs, the Philadelphia A's, and the Red Sox, I think, came that. He had five big league teams come to Reading in the span of about a month and a half as the season went to a close. And the interesting one, Connie Mack came to Reading because it resolved a dispute that Reading had with the Philadelphia A's. In baseball at that time, you were not allowed to broadcast your major league game on a radio, the local radio stations, if the minor league team was playing at that time.
Wow, right.
But Philadelphia A's said, yeah, right. And they continued to broadcast their Major League games while the Reading Brooks were playing. And
well, that's exactly what we do here. We play the Philadelphia Phillies every night.
Well, they're big. Well, that's not the law anymore. That's not the regs anymore. But anyhow, 24-year-old Lee McPhail brings August Connie Mack in front of Kennesaw Mountain Landis, speaking of an August figure. And Kennesaw Mountain Landis says to Connie, "I think the young man has you, Connie. But why don't I step out and you gentlemen resolve this?" So Connie said to Lee McPhail, "I'll bring the A's up for a game, and you have the whole gate." And and he said, "I like that, Connie." And so they drew 3,500 people when the A's came, which is not capacity, but it was more than what they had usually. So that was the resolution of the Connie Mack solution. But that was one of the five big league teams that came to Reading in a short period of time.
Let's talk about some of the major players, the famous legendary players who have played at First Energy Stadium. The cover on your book is a picture of Mike Schmidt after hitting a home run at First Energy Stadium in an exhibition game in 1971. Talk about the significance of that home run and how it played into Mike Schmidt's career, because he is such a famous player that just immediately clicks with anybody who's remotely interested in the Phillies and baseball.
I've had the good fortune of interviewing Mike a couple of times, and he remembers that home run very well. The circumstances were he was just off the Ohio U campus. He was a high draft choice signed by the Phillies, and they brought him into the vet to say, "Hey, kid, here, this is where you'll be playing eventually, and hey, guys, this is our kid." And he worked out, and they said, "By the way, we got a game in Reading tonight, an exhibition game. It's in the middle of the season. We're still when they play them." And he said, the manager said, "Boa says he's sick, doesn't want to come up." Nobody liked to come up to these games. "Would you like to play shortstop with us that night?" And Schmidt had played shortstop through college. He said, "Sure." So he played shortstop that night for the Philadelphia Phillies. And in the eighth inning, hit a home run that won the game for the—it was the go-ahead run. They had a 4-3 lead. It was the winning homer. And on the cover is a picture which is colorized and explained at First Energy Stadium. There's three things that are interesting. One is Schmidt is jogging home with a uniform number on that is not the number that he wore for the Reading Phillies, nor the Philadelphia Phillies during his career. But that's one. Number two, in the background is Bob Boone as the catcher and standing there. Well, he could have had a night off. Anyway, Mike Freemuth was the pitcher that they had gotten in a trade for Tony Taylor. And the other thing that's interesting is if you look in the background, Greg, the seats are empty. They had 3,200 people at the game for the Phillies,
and the people who are in the seats they're looking the other direction at the mountain. I don't know.
Well, the pagoda looked particularly nice.
Yeah, interested in the pagoda than.
Yeah, and the stands themselves look like high school bleachers. Just reminding again to the renovations in the stadium under the Craig Stein regime. How lucky we are. With even the bleacher seats are comfortable seats, so Schmidt, the Phillies said, "Okay, you hit a home run off a double A pitcher, Mike Freemuth. We were going to send you down to low A, but you know, as long as you hit a home run off a double A pitcher, you'll stay with Reading for the rest of the year."
Yeah, now, that was kind of his ticket in. That was kind of how he got his foot in the door.
He got his foot in the door. Unfortunately, the rest of the year with Reading, I think he hit 212, 210, something like that. He did not kick butt in the Eastern League for the balance of the season. He did well in spring training. They put him on he did not play with Reading the next year. But he said it stepped him ahead one closer year to getting the moolah in the big leagues. And he said financially that was a very prosperous home run for him because it was one step closer to a big league salary, which weren't what it is now, but it was a lot.
Oh, yeah. In 1971, and for someone making a career out of baseball, I mean, that's you made it. And it's so interesting to look at, you know, back then it wasn't retro, it was just the uniform, but the
yes.
I guess it's a good way to put it. The Phillies pee, kind of that cool curly pee there.
Yeah.
No, that's great. And this book is full of facts like that. Other big players that we know have played at First Energy Stadium, like Ryan Howard, even current players like Aaron Nola have pitched there.
Sure, lots. Actually, a couple of years ago, there was a prospects game, 2015. They had the Phillies prospects play minor league prospects, and they packed the house for that. And that meant I had to write another book, I guess. I don't. But that my book went to print in 2015, and the prospects game was a few years after that. But seeing that was a public relations coup for the Phillies, I believe, for Reading fans to have that happen. But yeah, we've seen Ryan Howard play here, not in an exhibition game. The last exhibition game the Phillies played here in the classic sense of Phillies versus Reading Phillies was in 2000. And notable in that game was Pete Rose Jr. During his tenure with the Phillies, brief tenure, organization, and he eventually did get a cup of coffee with the Cincinnati Reds, I believe, a very brief cup of coffee. But he hit a winning home run in the 2000 game. But Mike Drago, who had written me for years for the Reading Eagle, described this as like vinyl records, exhibition games are going to become a thing of the past. And like vinyl records, they are to be savored. But nonetheless, that was a prognostication by Mike that was right on the money.
As the years go by, the intensity of playing a major league season goes up, the frequency of games, the amount of training it takes. I mean, these guys are just absolutely jacked now. And, you know, there's a lot of more stringent toll on your body. As we go through the book, the guys in the early 1900s, they kind of just looked like normal guys. And even in the 70s, as time goes on, you know, just things get more tight. And I think that's why the exhibition games are falling out of fashion.
Well, the diversity of the teams that came through, diverse range of teams. The Brooklyn Dodgers came through here on a number of occasions. One was they played in 41. Oh, the Dodgers were the fifth team to come through. And they got beaten by the Reading Brooks. There's a picture in my book of Larry McPhail sitting next to Lise McPhail's, his son's very pretty young wife. And she's looking as polite as she can. Larry McPhail is looking very put out because his Brooklyn Dodgers, who would go on to win the 41 National League pennant, are getting their butts kicked by this low A minor league team. So, long and short of it, the Pirates came here for a number of games. As I said, the New York Giants had come through. The Yankees were never here. The Tigers were here. The Red Sox had been through here several times. The St. Louis Browns, as I said, the St. Louis Cardinals. When Whitey Kurowski, the game at George Field was put together, they played the Bowers Battery team. The goal of the game was to, they had a third of the gate go to Gerber Schaefer, I believe his name was, a World War I veteran. Who was in a wheelchair. A third of the gate went to the Reading team, and a third went to the Cardinals. But Whitey Kurowski, to show the economics of baseball, got a season pass at a movie theater, a local movie theater here, and a wallet and a set of golf clubs. That was what Whitey got as his prizes. And as my grandfather would say, and he was thankful.
I wish it's how he got paid today, you know. That sounds a lot better than just, you know, some mysterious paycheck with, you know, all
those zeros.
I'm also looking at, I mean, you open this book, I mean, like I said, there's a lot of cool pictures. There's a picture of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig in Reading.
They came to Reading, and I spent 15 hours interviewing a fellow about his time as recreation director of Reading, Bob Duddy, who's sadly passed away a number of years ago. I didn't realize Bob was 10 years old at that game. He was like the last living person that was at that.
October 20th, 1928, Bustin' Babes 9.
Larapin Luz.
Yeah, believe me, I read this, but I didn't get the pronunciation. Larapin Luz.
Yeah, the
Lou Gehrig 8.
Yeah, the Bustin' was one kind of company. The Larapin was a word that I think means you really dominate somebody, I do believe. But it was the two of them. They went on a tour. Babe Ruth had under him a team of local cops and firemen that played in the rec league. They were a good team. And under Gehrig was a bunch of local minor leaguers. And they played, and I forget who won, but Babe hit a couple of home runs off Gehrig, and Gehrig hit a home run off Babe when Babe went to pitch. And the story was there was a free breakfast beforehand, and that was packed. And at the game, they had 500 people.
The Eagle reported a big crowd in attendance. Eyewitness accounts put the number at around 500.
Yeah. But two from Baseball Valhalla were here on that morning in Saturday, 1928.
Reading has a lot of baseball history, clearly. First Energy Stadium, as we know, that people are going to on a pretty regular basis throughout the minor league season. 1951, that started. And then the Reading Phillies didn't even start till 1967, but that is tied for first for the longest franchise connected to an MLB team. So, as I said, I just with this whole podcast I'm doing the history of Reading, it's just amazing. You know, you take one topic and there's just encyclopedias worth of information, and it's really so interesting. Some of the big names that came here that have played over the last 100 years. I mean,
Rogers Hornsby, Christy Mathewson. You know, I mean, Shoeless Joe Jackson, who's not in the Hall of Fame, but Pete Rose came here a number of games when he was on the Phillies, and Larry Doby. So the list goes on and on and on. But
and First Energy Stadium, currently they have the whole wall of history there.
Yes. And they have pictures in left field of everybody that's in the Hall of Fame that ever played here, either in an exhibition game or for a minor league team. And there was a committee that went together, got put together, and I had the privilege of being on that committee, of researching and finding all these people. But yeah, it was, we've had the great Bill Mazeroski played a minor league game here with whatever team he was with. But we had all kinds of, also Satchel Paige played in an exhibition game here. So anyway,
it's just amazing. Your book, Reading's Big League Exhibition Games, by Brian C. Engelhardt.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
The book was a labor of love. I got my start in writing from the Reading Phillies. They engaged me. They would say, if you write an article, you get 2 free tickets. They can do that. And they gave me my start. And I've also gotten... I write for the Review, the Historical Review.
Yeah.
Half of my royalties go to the Reading Phillies charity, Baseball Town Charities. The other half goes to the Berks Historical Society. So
yes.
I got no dog in the race here, except for movie rights. But in any event, I just wanted that. And it's short captions, and there's tidbits, nuggets, and gems, a lot of which have humor in them.
The pictures are incredible.
Thank you.
Great descriptions. It's just so interesting. It's an easy read, just about 125 pages around, so not too much of a task, but it's just great. So,
well, I'm glad you liked it, Greg.
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Brian Engelhardt. Just a wealth of knowledge on the history of baseball in Reading. And if anyone listening can get out to a Reading Phillies game, it's a great time. They made all those renovations to the stadium, so there's more options, more room, more seating. It's just all around great. I've had the honor of diving into this topic of Reading baseball. I grew up playing baseball. I've played baseball in Reading. The fact that I get to do this now is just quite an honor, and to talk to you and the people of Reading.
It's an honor that you invited me to come, and I appreciate that greatly. Thank you very
much. Of course, absolutely. This is Our Roots in Reading podcast. I'm your host, Greg Cobill. Please like and subscribe if you can. You can access this on the 830 WEEU website or Spotify or all the podcast sites. Give a rating, a like, a follow. I greatly appreciate it. It really helps us out. And until next time, this is Baseball in Reading, and have a good night. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.